Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome, welcome, welcome to Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and tonight our special guest will be Dr. Walter Williams on An African Boy Finds His Way Back to Egypt. Now, we have some questions that we're going to be answering here tonight. We got some plugs. We're going to hear from our several different angles here tonight because we're going to make sure that the questions that's in most people's mind are going to be answered tonight. That's my primary objective. The first question is, where is Egypt? Okay, we're going to deal with that. Why are these pyramids in America? Are all black people in America from Africa? When did we all become Africans? Where did the word Egypt come from? Who are the people in Egypt today calling themselves Egyptians? Who are these people? Are these people the same people who built the pyramids that we see today? Are they the actual descendants of the people who actually built the pyramids? Because if they didn't, and if they're not, what in that are they talking about? That's what I want to know. But nevertheless, we're going to roll on with this thing. Keep in mind the chat room is open. The number to dial into the broadcast is 515-605-9757. Press 1 on your phone. When we open up the phone line, that'll give you something to say. So please be courteous and respectful in the chat room, okay? We're going to take a little quick break because it appears that my guests have not shown up yet. So we're going to take a little quick break, and when we come back, we're going to go down into this thing, okay? Let's start here with this sister he got.
Recently, there has been a lot of conversation when it comes to Egyptians, specifically black Egyptians, even when it comes to ancient Egyptians like Cleopatra and the pharaohs, like what did they look like? Were they Nubian? What was the culture like? We have talked about it all. I recently came across a black Egyptian and a proud Egyptian, I might add. Her name is Ranim and she has a jewelry line named Cairo and she advocates for her people. She makes jewelry. She seems very proud about her culture. But unfortunately, Egyptians are telling her that she's not Egyptian because she's black. Let me show you this clip. We'll come back and discuss.
Hey guys, so I've been running my Egyptian jewelry brand for about 3 years now, and if you've been following me on TikTok, you know that every time a TikTok goes viral where I mention that I'm Egyptian, I get a lot of hate. And it's I don't know why I'm laughing, it's not funny, it's serious. Yeah, I get a lot of hate, and it is from Egyptians telling me that I'm not Egyptian, which is fun. It's what everyone wants to hear. In the beginning, I used to get really upset. I didn't even know that we had a slur for black people in Egypt before I started TikTok. Like, I lived such a naive life. I remember the first time somebody used a slur on me, I literally went to my mom and I thought they were calling me like zesty, like exotic. And I went to her and I was like, what does this mean? And she was like, The reason I do reply to these videos now is not to say I'm upset. And it's not out of anger or like being hurt or anything like that. It's more so that we can keep this conversation in the spotlight to show people that, yes, racism is bad in Egypt. Like, it's really bad. Like, it's awful. Something I want to make very clear. One, not all Egyptians are racist, so don't come in the comments being like, Egyptians are the worst, blah, 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 because no. So this is the thing. The racism I get is from Egyptians back home, not in the diaspora. But the Egyptians back home are well aware that black Egyptians exist. They know about Nubians. They know about Aswan. Like, they know that darker-skinned Egyptians are around, more so than Egyptians in the diaspora. But the thing is, we are not represented. They're used to seeing white Egyptians represent them. Even on TikTok, and I have not seen Egyptians that look like me with a platform on TikTok. So when they see a dark-skinned Egyptian being successful and claiming to be Egyptian, no way. The audacity of this girl to try and claim that she's Egyptian, because we don't let people like you succeed. One time, somebody tried to apologize for the racism I experienced in Egypt by saying, but I mean, don't be upset about the racism. It's just because they don't expect Nubians to do well. Like, are we sure that's how we want to apologize? So I'm just hoping by me continually bringing these videos to the spotlight, maybe other people can start talking about racism too, that it is in Egypt, because I know that every single Egyptian is aware of the racism in Egypt. Not one Egyptian can come and tell me that there isn't racism in Egypt and it's not a huge problem, because they would be lying. For Ramadan? But yeah, so I'm going to keep making these videos just to make sure that this conversation doesn't stop and that it is something that we can work towards solving.
As you heard, Ranim said that this is not the only time that she faced this. She gets these comments here and there, and she decided to talk about it because she believes it needs to be discussed, which she's right, it needs to be discussed, especially in this climate where black Egyptians are being hidden. Like, they don't even want to admit that there are black Egyptians. They don't want to even admit that there's Nubians. They look down on Nubians, as you heard her say, and obviously needs to be called out, because if left unchecked, what we have witnessed recently will continue happening. There's a lawyer that is suing Netflix for casting a black woman for the Cleopatra role. Things like that will be normal, and they will continue erasing history. That is why it needs to be discussed. Well done to this beautiful young lady for speaking up. Anyways, fam, let us know down below what your thoughts are about this. I am Ongil Zalalam. I'll see you on the next one. Bye. Recently, there has been a...
Okay. Now, this is the situation. I'm going to break it down for you. You come to me and you say, can I borrow your shovel? I say, sure, I'll go get it for you. I go get the shovel. I loan you my shovel. You don't bring the shovel back. Days pass by. Weeks pass by. Months pass by. Years pass by. And then one day I say, well, look, when are you going to return my shovel? What shovel you talking about? I'm talking about the shovel that I loaned you that you borrowed from me. Oh, man, I ain't got nothing over here but my shovel. Well, could I look at it? Well, no, it's my shovel. Well, you don't have a shovel. The only shovel you have is my shovel. This situation. See, you these people here that's occupying the land today that they call Egypt, when they came into the land, the people were already there. They kept coming in more and more and more, and they stayed and stayed. And eventually, the original inhabitants of the land began to die out or move out or what have you. Now that these people are occupying the land, they see one of us come over there on the land. They were, what you doing here? Well, I'm an Egyptian. No, you're not Egyptian. This is Egypt. We're the Egyptians. No. You kind of came lately. You ain't nothing but an occupier. This is not your land. You don't belong on this land. You came from somewhere else. And now you're in there whitewashing stuff and trying to cover up so you can hold on to the shovel. You won't give the shovel back. This is amazing. This is the kind of situation that we are dealing with. And the same thing happened to Chancellor Williams, the author of the Destruction of Black Civilization. He went into Egypt. They had a fleet of limousines. They had on one of the limousines that he's riding in, they had the United States emblem on the side of the car and two flags on the hood of the car waving to come in there. They almost wanted to arrest the man. He had to go in there. They had to question him. They had to drill him. They had to do all these different things before they could even, because they were, well, why are you here? You black. You didn't come back to get your shovel, did you? Okay. Well, nevertheless, we're going to get down into the broadcast. It appears that my guest is on the line. I'm going to open up the phone line and let him in. Dr. Walter Williams. Dr. Williams, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Dr. Hoffa, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I can hear you loud and clear, sir.
Okay. All right. So let me begin. The topic of our discussion tonight is a African boy finds his way back to ancient Egypt. And that African boy was me, Walter Williams. In 1939, sitting in a classroom in an elementary school in Chicago, they gave me a book called Little Black Sambo. And Little Black Sambo, for all who doesn't know about Little Black Sambo, Little Black Sambo is an African boy that took the tiger around by the tail and went around and around and around a tree until they both turned to feather. Now, that was supposed to be my history, our history as a people. And they gave that book also to the little white child sitting in their elementary school. Now, this story about Little Black Sambo was to degrade us as an African people and make us feel very bad, which it made me feel very bad. And it was also given to this white child to make him feel superior over us as an African people. So I said to myself, I said, now, I'm 8 years old now. I'm saying to myself, we as an African people living in the United States of America, it's got to be better than a little black Sambo. So I set out to find our greatness as an African people. In the meantime, I became a musician. And right out of high school, 18 years old, going on 19 years old, I met a man by the name of Sun Ra. And all the young guys playing music would go up to his house to hear him philosophize. And Sun Ra was old enough to be our father. The young guys were coming around him, such as myself. And he said one day that we, as an African people, came from the greatest civilized people that has ever lived on this planet called Earth. And he said they are known as the ancient Egyptians. But now, by me being 19 and hearing this, it didn't click into me that this is my answer trying to search for our great roots as an African people. So what happened in 1975, my wife and I went to Italy because her three sisters worked at Illinois Bell Telephone Company right here in Chicago. And Illinois Bell Telephone Company was offering a very inexpensive trip, round trip to Italy. So my wife and I hooked on to that trip. And while in Italy, now I'm 44 years old now, while in Italy, the Italian guide on the bus said these words: when the Romans, talking about the Italians, went to Egypt to receive civilization, a bright light just lit up inside of me, ping! And I didn't know what was happening to me, but that light woke me up, and I made a vow to myself: when I get back to America, I will get me a magnifying glass, and every pictorial book that's depicting the ancient Egyptians, I will use my magnifying glass and look in the faces of the pictures in there depicting ancient Egyptians. I was looking for evidence that these people looked at me, looked like you, looked like us as Africans in America. So once I was convinced of that, I was on my way. Also, I made a vow to myself: I'll find any book that had the title of history on that book, because I wanted to study history along with ancient Egyptian identity. So I got back to America, and I went down into the studio of a friend of mine. He and I went to DuSable High School together right here in Chicago. And we played in the band at DuSable. And he was teaching a saxophone lesson. And he was in another room teaching the saxophone lesson. And he had a shelf of books in his studio. So I went to the bookcase, and I saw a book that said The Outline of History by H.G. Wells. Now, I opened the book up. I didn't thumb through the pages. I just opened it up, you know, and what was staring at me was a picture of what I thought was Jesus the Christ. But it said in the caption, Serapis. And then I began to read about Serapis. He says, in the cult of Serapis, he is spoken of as the Savior. I said, well, wow. I said, this is the same attributes that they give to this Jesus the Christ. Then it went on to say that he raises the dead. I said, wow, this is the same attributes that they give to this Jesus the Christ. Then it went on to say, you will always be in the presence of Serapis or Serapis, whatever name you want to call it, even after death. I said, wow. I said, this is what they said. All funerals. The preacher would tell the listening audience in the funeral home that old Mose has gone on to be in heaven with God. So I said, now there's something that's wrong here. I said, let me put on a historical research to get more information about the Serapis. And I went out for 2 years searching and trying to find all the evidence and information that I could find on this image, Serapis. And after 2 years of research, I began to realize that there's never been a man that ever walked the earth in human form with a race, creed, or color by the name of Jesus Christ. And I was hurt because I knew that our people in the African community were so involved with this image that they called Jesus the Christ. And here I'm finding out there's never been a man that ever walked the earth in human form of any race, creed, or color by the name of Jesus Christ. At that point about ancient Egypt, I bought an old mansion in Chicago.
Excuse me, Dr. Williams. Dr. Williams, can you cut your volume up some?
Okay, can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I hear you a little bit better. Are you not on the speaker or something, are you? Could you, like, speak directly?
Yeah, I'm speaking directly.
All right, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, so, again, I bought an old mansion. And I turned that mansion, as I remodeled it, into a ancient Egyptian museum. I opened the doors March 11, 1990. In the meantime, I was finishing up writing my book, The Historical Origin of Christianity. And that book was published in 1993, 3 years after I had opened up the Ancient Egyptian Museum. And so that's how I found my way back to ancient Egypt, to the point of finding out also that there's never been a man that ever walked the earth in human form, but a race, creed, or color by the name of Jesus Christ. So most of the listening audience have that tape that I made in 1993 on a television show called The Great Debate. And I debated 5 men on that day that I was invited to come into the television studio by a man by the name of W.L. Lillard. And he set a trap for me, supposedly now, for me to be attacked and demised by the people that he had bought there to do just that. It was Prince Asael Ben Israel was one of them. He died last year. and a minister by the name of Henry Hardy, who has a large Christian church here in Chicago, and then there was Munir Muhammad. He was a follower of the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad, and he died also. And then there was the lawyer Chester Blair. He was there because I said that Africans born in the United States of America are not citizens of the United States of America due to the Constitution drawn up in 1787. By him being a lawyer, he has to defend the Constitution because he took an oath to defend that. And so we had words back and forth, so I knocked him out of the box. And then there was W.L. Lillard, the fifth person that I debated, but he had set all this up for me, so therefore he didn't want me to speak as long as he gave the other speakers time to speak. So when I began to speak, and the listening audience began to clap and cheer from the words that I was saying to defend myself, he told me to cut it. I said, well, no, I'm not going to cut it, because you gave everybody on this panel time to say what they had to say. So that's how I came about. And right after that, during that time, I had written this book, The Historical Origin of Christianity. There's never been a man that ever walked the earth in human form of any race, creed, or color by the name of Jesus Christ. And then in the year 2003, I wrote my second book that's out there called The Historical Origin of Islam. There's never been a man that ever walked the earth in human form of any race, creed, or color by the name of Prophet Muhammad of Islamic tradition. That's out there today as I speak. So that's part and of the information that fits the title that we're dealing with now about an American boy finding his way back to ancient Egypt. So I am the boy that found his way back to ancient Egypt. Brother Sahafa?
Okay, Dr. Williams, I do have some questions. I'm going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, I have questions for you, okay?
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, you hold on a minute. The number to dial into the broadcast is 515-605-9757. Press 1 on your phone. That'll give me an indication that you have something to say to our special guest. Y'all on a minute, we'll be right back.
What are the
okay?
benefits of becoming a secured party? Number one, operating financially in the private. Number two, controlling all assets of the corporate fiction. Number three, avoiding the legal system, which includes police and courts. Four, having access to your direct treasury account. Many wealthy and well-to-do people use this benefit every day. You will benefit in this way because of the current financial structure of the U.S. and other countries. You can operate right in the privacy of your own home. And you gain the benefit and avoid the losses by starting now, today. Contact me, Tahaka, and I will show you how to do it. Go to www.tahakadebtelimination.org. Child support, student loan, mortgages, foreclosures, property taxes, you name it, credit card debt, is just a drop in the bucket once you get yourself in the proper status of commerce. Contact me, Tahaka. Peace.
Okay, everybody, we're back. Now, Dr. Williams, for those people here in the listening audience who are new. The people that are occupying the land today in North Africa, who they have a problem with people that look like you and I coming over there to the land. And we dare not say that, well, we're Egyptians. I mean, they got a real serious problem. And I gave an analogy today about the shovel. Borrowing somebody's shovel, and you come back and ask for your shovel and had it so long, so they assume that it's theirs. So could you tell the new people listening on this who these people are? Because I find the land in mass. And where did they came from and when?
Well, the people that's over there occupying Egypt today are not ancient Egyptians. In order to be an ancient Egyptian, you have to be an African. That's number one. And they are not African. Where did they come from? They're Arabs. They came out of Afghanistan. Okay, Afghanistan borders Northeast Africa. Northeast Africa is known by a nickname as the Middle East, which the British gave that name to that area after World War I. So they came out of Afghanistan. They came from the Tora Mountains, where Bin Laden was hiding after 9/11. And then they also came from the Caspian Sea area of Afghanistan. That's two. They came from Turkestan in Afghanistan. That's three. They came from Pakistan, which borders Afghanistan and merges with Afghanistan. That's four. They came out of the North Caucasus Mountain region of Afghanistan. The North Caucasus Mountain region extends from Russia into Afghanistan. That's five. Then they came from Azerbaijan, which is six, which is a country that is controlled by the Russians, and Armenia, that's seven, which is a country controlled by Armenia. So they came over in this hemisphere in 1071 under the name of the Seljukian Turks, and they settled in Turkey, and then they began to still come in and come in and come in until they crossed the Suez Canal and the Red Sea going into Egypt and occupying Egypt. So that's what's over there today. They had nothing to do with civilization as we know it today. There's only one race of people that is credited with bringing civilization to all of humanity. And those people are known today as the ancient Egyptians. Okay? So therefore, you have to realize points that I'm about to bring out to you, Brother Saraka. Let me ask you a question. Did civilization start in China?
Nope.
Did civilization start in India?
No.
Did civilization start in Europe?
No.
Did civilization start in Africa?
I have to put a yes on that.
That's correct. Civilization started in Africa. Had nothing to do with the present day people over there in Egypt. It's calling themselves Egyptians. You see? So I told you where these people came from, but now they're not ancient Egyptians. You have to be an African to be an ancient Egyptian. See? So if you want to be an Egyptian, that's what's over there today in Egypt, occupying over there. Okay? So now, our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, brought forth civilization to all of humanity during the time of antiquity. How did they do this? They were the ones that created the world's first the world's first alphabet. And from that alphabet comes literacy, because the alphabet is the first thing that you learn when you go to school. It's your ABC. And with that alphabet, you're able to read, write, and spell, thus making you literate. Then from that same alphabet came the musical scale. Do, re, mi, so, fa, la, ti, do. That's where the musical scale came from. It's that alphabet created by our ancestors during the time of antiquity. And the ancient Egyptians were the first musicians on earth. They were women, female women of ancient Egypt. They were the first musicians ever to be musicians on this planet called Earth. Then our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, created every form of mathematics, all forms of mathematics. And then they created a mathematical formula as to how to build the Great Pyramid. And with that formula has never been understood by other humans on Earth. So they use that formula to build the greatest edifice that has ever been built by man, called the Great Pyramid. Okay? And that pyramid that they built is so awesome that it went from the ground up to 490 stories high. And that pyramid is on your dollar bill today as you go through life in America. It's on your back of your dollar bill, that pyramid. And the seal of America is on there, that eagle. That's the seal of America on their currency. So, and the base of the pyramid is 756 feet wide on all four sides. And they also built the Sphinx, the Great Sphinx. The Sphinx, as I speak, is two city blocks long, six stories high, with an African face carved in the body of the Sphinx. So you're talking about a people that has to be, you have to know your history to separate your people. As when I said your people, our people, as being the ancient Egyptians, from a mixture of people that's over there today, with those white faces, those Arabs over there calling themselves Egyptians. So that's the difference, Brother Tahaka.
Okay, Dr. Williams, I thank you for explaining that to us in detail. Now, my next question, I'm going to need your personal opinion on this one, Dr. Williams. Where did the word Egypt come from?
The word Egypt came from this, when Alexander the Great came into Egypt, and he was in awe of the civilization that our ancestors had created there. He decided to stay there and become part of that civilization. But he was met by the male Coptic Egyptians who ran the government of ancient Egypt. And seeing that they were not going to leave, I'm talking about the Greeks were not going to leave, the Melkite set out to learn the Greek language. So in order for them to communicate with the Greeks, they had to learn their language. So with them speaking back and forth to the Greeks asked them, the Melkite Egyptians, who are people? And then speaking Greek, the ancient Egyptians said, we are Egyptos, Egyptus. Okay? And today the people say, oh, Egypt is a Greek word. That's how it got to be a Greek word. And that's how Egypt came about. The word Egypt came about is from our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, the male Coptic Egyptians who ran the government of ancient Egypt. That's my answer to you, Tarka.
Okay, well, I thank you very much, Dr. Williams. I'm hoping Brother Yoel is joining us here this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, the phone lines are open now. The number to dial in is 515-605-9757. If you have a question or comment to our guest, Dr. Walter Williams, go ahead and press 1 on your phone. That'll give me an indication that you have something to say and open up the phone lines so you can get in. Okay? Now, Dr. Williams, why do you think that the people that are occupying the land in North Africa that we're calling Egypt, why do you think they are getting so upset? They got upset about the movie they brought out, Cleopatra, with the Netflix movie. And then when people that go over there that they consider to be Negroes, Black, African Americans, colored, all that there, when we go over there, they have a problem with it. They get upset. Why do you think that is?
Well, the reason why they get upset over there is that they don't want you near ancient Egypt. Some of the American so-called Negro over in this country, they don't want us near ancient Egypt. They don't want us near that. So we have been taught away from ancient Egypt in the school system. This is a race war that's going on. So they have been taught us away from ancient Egypt, colonized our minds, committed genocide on our thinking, kept us from knowing who we are racially. They get upset when you go over there because here they say, well, they're so afraid that you're going to identify with them, with the ancient Egyptians. And that upsets them. So when you go over there, you in Egypt, when I went there in 1993, with my group from the museum, we were greeted at the airport by Nubians. The Nubians are the last vestige of the descendants of ancient Egyptians. And we were met, they said, Americans, Americans, I'm Nubian. And you're my Nubian cousin. You know, so they don't want you there. They've been digging over there and plundering our ancestors' graves for over 260 years, they've been doing it. So they don't want us there to claim that greatness because white people cannot take no one to Europe and show any greatness coming from Europe that will equal the greatness of the pyramids, the Sphinx, and the civilization that came out of ancient Egypt. Can't show you that. The Indians of India can't take you into India and show you anything of greatness that will equal what was produced by way of the pyramids, the Sphinx, and the civilization, the alphabet, or anything like that. They can't show you that. The people of China can't take you into China and show you anything that's great that the Chinese produce that will equal the great spent. So they don't want you there. See? So that is one of the main answers that I'll give you, Brother Tahaka.
Okay, Dr. Williams, thank you. Okay, now, my next question is this, and this is a very, very important question. The people that are there now occupying the land, since they have been there on this land, occupying the land, calling themselves, you know, perpetrating a fraud, calling themselves Egyptians and eschewing a way of getting rid of, trying to get rid of anybody that's real or the rightful owners of the land, could you tell us, since they've been there, what have they built or contributed to civilization?
The answer is nothing. Nothing whatsoever. See, civilization was over when Alexander came into Egypt in 332 BCE. Our ancestors had a civilization up and running for 9,668 years before the Greeks came in there. So they, no one on earth can contribute anything and add on to the civilization of the world or the civilization of ancient Egypt. So that will be my answer to you. They contribute nothing.
Okay, well, Dr. Williams, before we get too further down with the rest of the questions I have, could you bring us up to speed on your new book that's coming out? And could you give us a little bit more for the new people that are listening here this evening?
Yes, okay. I have a new book coming out called Dispelling Myths of Ancient Egypt. And that book, I'm looking for it to come out around late summer or early fall, because I'm adding a lot of information, new information, to the book. Let me give you, you and the listening audience, a little peek into the book. On chapter 6, I believe, that chapter is entitled Civilization, the Ancient Egyptians' Gift to the World. And I list all the things that the ancient Egyptians brought to civilization. And the next chapter is a chapter called Death and Destruction. The European, in parentheses, white people's gift to the world. And I list the things that they have brought to this world, that such as lies, deceit, murder, injustice, corruption, greed, terrorism, militarism, sexism, racism, slavery, exploitation, misery, evilness, genocide, hypocrisy, cheating, stealing, suffering, drugs, disease, death, destruction, war, guns, bombs, bullets, plunder, rape, hate, suffering, white supremacy, white superiority, religion, mythology, and perverted scholarship. This is what they brought to the world. Nothing but total destruction. Like you can, evidence of it, you can see it every day, right before your eyes. The whole world can see it. So, and then I'm writing my last chapter in this book. The title of the last chapter that I'm writing is called America, the Hypocrite. America, the Hypocrite. And I show and walk you through why America is a hypocrite. See? And then the last section in that book will be, I have a picture gallery showing us, as we look today, at the ancient Egyptians, like they looked during the time of antiquity, as we look today, and the, our ancestors, as they looked during the time of antiquity, look alike. So I'm bringing all that out. I got about 30 pages of pictures. So it's very, very exciting to bring this book out to our African community. Brother Tahaka?
Okay, Dr. Williams. Now, you explained it to us, and we all looking forward to getting a copy of your new book. And what I'm going to do, you've been going for a while. I'm going to take a little quick break, and we'll come back. I want to hear from this gentleman. He, too, said he had been to Egypt, and he wants to tell us about his experience in Egypt when he went there and how he was treated. So we're going to take a little quick break, and I'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, y'all hold on for a minute. We will be right back.
Every time I travel to a new place, I ask myself, who influenced the way that I think? And I keep coming back to this Western culture, then oftentimes, honestly, dysfunctional Black culture, a lot of dysfunctional white culture, a lot of misinformation, and the power of that misinformation has literally shaped so many aspects of my life and how I see the world, my worldview, and how I see people. Take a look at some of my thoughts on this, and there's more on the way. So I'm now here at one of the ancient mosques in Cairo, Egypt. And I think that this particular talk is really relevant because throughout my whole life growing up in the Black Christian world, at every turn, we were discouraged from even learning about these places. You know, even when I posted I was in Egypt, you know, the first thing everybody went, they're not us, they don't like us, they don't. You know, and it's the same narrative that people have been telling me about West Africa. They don't go there. They don't like us. They're not us. They're not, you know, so if I don't have enough sense to be able to, you know, come and see and learn, then I will believe something based on information that may or may not be true. So, like the other night, you know, when I showed a video of going to have dinner with the family here in Egypt. They're Muslim. They don't primarily speak any, only three members speak English. But they welcome me into their home in a way that I can't get from many of the Christians. You know what I'm saying? So, and not to throw shade that way at all, but just saying, when you start, what I've had to learn how to start doing is taking it on a case-by-case basis and not lumping people together. When you start lumping people together, then you miss out on the beautiful side of it. That was a beautiful moment, sitting there with that family on the floor and eating with them. We don't even speak the same language, but we can share a meal. You know, that's there's something powerful about that. And so what I've learned as I'm maturing my mindset is the value in appreciating the individual people instead of getting caught up in they don't like me and living monolithically. And I think that's where many of us miss out, because we do things in a monolithic way. We lump people together in a monolithic way. And when we do that, we miss out on a lot of valuable friendships and a lot of valuable experiences. So in coming to Egypt, you know, it's no, this is not West Africa. This is a very different culture, and it's a very different part of the world, but nonetheless very important and a part of the continent of Africa and all of what Africa has to offer. And so when we begin to understand that, there are lessons here, there are pieces of the puzzle here. Just as I said when I was in the museum, there are pieces of the puzzle here that you won't get anyplace else. But if we're afraid to come, then we miss out. And some people are, you know, content living, you know, however they're living. But for me, I just said I was not going to allow other people's narratives to shape how I live. So anyway, this is, you know, just great to be here in Egypt, seeing the people. The people have been exceptionally nice. I've not experienced all of the negativity that everybody tells me about. I know there's more to the story. I know that this is one aspect of it. I definitely want to speak to some of the Nubian tribes and learn what their situations are like. But again, I take people as individuals. I think that's the lesson in my world travels. I take people as individuals, and I get out of the monolithic, lumping everybody together. Because you know, those of us who are part of the African diaspora would have a problem. They said all them people from the African diaspora, they don't like us. And then you got somebody who's very loving and very kind and very open and very welcoming, they get lumped into that group together, and that's unfair. So anyway, here, Cairo, Egypt, having a great time, and hope that you would have the opportunity to come and see this for yourself, see it all for yourself. I wanted to come back with this real quick, because the other thing that I thought about is how, you know, you might be dealing with, very well be dealing with a very racist system, meaning a lot of the Arab systems are racist. They had the whole history with the East African slave trade. When you look into that, it was as brutal, if not worse, than the European chattel slave trade. If I just look at the system and eliminate the millions of people that are probably oppressed within, meaning there are probably Arabs who are oppressed, light skin, dark skin, you name it, who are oppressed by these same systems of oppression, because, one, you know, whatever the narratives are, whether it's greed or whatever. So what I do, as someone who, again, is maturing in my mentality, is I go to look for the individual. Like I was telling somebody one time, I said, it's like a double-edged sword. I said, the people who support me and encourage me, majority of them are Black American or African. But then I have my white friends who are like, man, Jay, keep doing what you're doing. I'm learning from you. This is inspiring me because I'm learning something I didn't know, because I was educated in the same system that miseducated all of us. So do I negate that person? I mean, and I can't. You know, for me, I cannot do that because I know the role that many ethnicities helped in my development. I know the role that one of my first jobs was with a Hispanic man named Demas, and he gave me my first job, taught me how to rehab houses. One of my best friends in junior high school and high school is Chinese. You know, I grew up around all ethnicities, white, Black, Indian. So do I now, because of what, you know, social pressure, because sometimes what people try to do is pressure you to take on their offense. And you just can't pressure me to take on an offense that I don't have. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't recognize the realities of what's going on, because I do recognize what's going on. But is that everybody? And I will always tell a story about the man who, his name was David Robeson. And while my Black, so-called African-American father was absent, running around doing his thing, David Robeson, a white man, was creating memories for me that I hold true to this day. All of these years later, he died in 1986, but I still call his name today. And so if I walk around looking at everybody like, oh man, these people just don't like me, then I would be disingenuous. And so what I'm saying is that a lot of us are missing out on relationships, opportunities, and all of that because we're holding grudges based on, sometimes it's other people's perspectives and opinions and culture. Now, this is another thing I won't do, because I remember I did an interview with a gentleman named Wale, and he talked about how when he was growing up, he was beat up by white people and all of that. So his perspective is different. So I respect the fact that he has hesitations there because of his encounters. And so, and I'm not going to try to project on him, hey, don't, you know, just see it the way I see it. He has his experience, and that's how it is. So what I've learned to do is to respect our collective experiences, because we've all, you know, we all have all of that, and not be walking around, because walking around with a chip on my shoulder, walking around looking funny, these people don't like me. I'm telling you, it's interesting when people walk around with that narrative, because they're already on edge and don't even give people a chance. Now, I'm not saying being naive and just being wide open, but I'm just saying, consider the source of your information, and whether it's a propaganda, is it one person's perspective, maybe it's your perspective, I don't know, but I'm just saying, all of these things I take into consideration now, and it has created a very freeing space for me, and it's in the chains. I don't have chains. If you look at my pictures and stuff, I don't have chains. I'm not walking around, you know, oh man, I'm scared of the Muslims, I'm scared of these people, I'm scared of them. No, I'm not afraid of anyone. As a matter of fact, I'm not supposed to have that type of mindset or that vibe about me, so why should I be afraid? And that comes off, and it comes across to other people. Even when I don't speak the language, they can sense that I'm not afraid of them, and they can sense that that there's something genuine, and that's why I'm able to flow in these places. Now, I can step to folks, too. Now, don't get me wrong, these Egyptians got a hustle over here that have caused me to bring out my inner Nigerian, my inner Ghanaian, my Black American hood, my the European side. It caused me to bring everything out, because they got a hustle here that don't stop, it don't quit, you know what I'm saying? But but it's time enough for them. Anyway, more on the way. Just be mindful of that monolithic thinking, because it can keep the chains around your neck for real. It'll keep you on lock, man.
We are here in Cairo, Egypt.
Hello.
And this is how we do it.
Hello.
Hey, what's your name?
Sarah.
Yes.
Now, let me say this. I was just talking about, and they just walked up to me, and they were just as nice as they could be. You know, this is a priceless moment. And so you have to take a selfie with me, right?
Yeah.
Can I take one? So I'm taking one right now. I love this. All right, so you all take a picture. And what's your name? What's your name back here?
Kaneen.
Oh, see, look, see. I would not have had this experience, y'all. I'm telling you. It's priceless. Ah, look at the fellas over here. All right. All right, so we're going to take a selfie. But this is just what I was talking about. It just happened when I wrapped up the video. All right. Hey, look, I know that when you go to places like China and other places that they'll want to take pictures with you because they don't get a chance to see a lot of quote-unquote so-called Black African-Americans. But part of changing the narrative is that experience, that encounter with me was a positive one for her and those young people. And it's no telling how long they'll carry that experience for the rest of their lives. And so, hey, you know what? It is what it is. And my narrative has been changed because of the kindness that they extended. You never know what that does in that moment. That's all.
Okay, everybody, we're back. I'm going to open up the phone line, let my guests get back in. Dr. Williams, are you still with me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to bring out this guy's perspective. He's over there in Egypt, and he was pretty much saying a lot of the stuff that I was saying. They do have a problem, but then there are a whole lot of people who don't see it that way. But I have experienced it right here inside the United States, and I'm not bashing everybody. I deal with things as I come in contact with it. But I do know that is exactly the way you said it was. We've been taught away from this stuff. They got a cover-up going on, even about the pyramids and stuff in the Americas. And I've been spending months of deep research about this stuff over here, man, and it is phenomenal. But nevertheless, we're talking about the African boy that finds his way back to Egypt. You have anything else that you would like to add?
Well, I think I added and told the story by way of narrating the African boy, which was me, and I found my way back to ancient Egypt after 36 years. I was 44 years old when I found my way back. And today, as I speak, I'm 91. In 3 months, I'll be 92 years old. And see, everything that I'm talking and explain on this program is strictly from memory. I have no notes or anything like that, you know. So my mind, I keep sharp by focusing on history. See, history will give us the only entity that will bring us to as to who we are as a people. History will do that. You've got to know history, time, people, places, events. And you've got to have literature to document the time of real people, time of real events, and the time of what's going on at that time. See, so you got to know your history. And I go to the foundation of every subject that I go to or narrate. I use the foundation of that subject. And once you get the foundation of that subject, then you can see the bigger picture. You know, as information come and be attached to that foundation, you'll know whether that's the truth or not. You see? So that's where I am today. I strictly go to the foundation of all subjects. Brother Tahaka.
Okay. Now, Dr. Williams, since the time when you found out about your identity as a descendant of the ancient Egyptians, apart from the situation with the Great Debate, what other type of opposition did you run into when you began going on this line of thinking?
Well, the only opposition that I ran into is from the African conscious community. Okay? When I said that there's never been a man that ever walked away from human form by the name of Jesus Christ. Oh, I stepped on many toes in the African community. And ASCAC, that group, they set out to destroy a Walter Williams, and they couldn't do it because I didn't realize at the point that these Africans out here who are conscious of ancient Egypt, who are conscious of, you know, what is happening to us or what has happened to us in America and so forth and so on, that they were Christians. I thought that once I brought this information of Jesus Christ to the African community, that I would be heralded as a hero, but I wasn't. You know, so that kind of set up made me realize that what I was up against. So that's what I have to say to that, Brother Tahaka.
Okay, so now
let me say this.
Go ahead.
On the hieroglyphics being deciphered, that's another thing that they fought me on. And to the point that I had to write why the Meta-Nature hieroglyphics has never been deciphered. And that's in my The Historical Origin of Christianity book. I had to sit down and write that as to why. And so they fought me on that, you know. And but they couldn't win because I brought evidence to the table where it's impossible for anybody to decipher a hieroglyphic. Brother Tahaka?
Okay. All right, now, you are of the persuasion that all of us in this country today that's classified as Negro, Black, African-American, so on and so forth, all of us are here as a result of coming here from Africa. Is that your position?
No.
Okay.
You came over here before 1619, which is the beginning of the African slave trade in America. You came over here because of the Spanish and Roman Catholic Church Inquisition that was called by Ferdinand and Isabella in 1478 to erase and get rid of all traces of an African ever contributing to the civilization of Spain and contributing to the creation of the Vatican. They want the world to know that the Africans brought civilization to Spain and built the church over there called the Roman Catholic Church. They didn't want that to happen and be known. And they didn't want the people to know that these Africans known as the Moors, which is a nickname given to the ancient Egyptians by the Spanish-speaking Moors, when they ask ASK, the ancient Egyptians, to come into Spain to bring civilization. Once in Spain, they call them black or Moors. Black and Negro is synonymous. So, and then when they was called into the Vatican, I'm sorry, into Italy in 1445, after the 12 humanists, six at the word humanist is a would be known as an intellectual day, that they studied at the Curia there in Florence, and they studied at the Curia in Ferrara, Italy. And that's when I said the last show that I was on about Manuel Chrysostomus and those Africans going over there, opening up the Renaissance for the European. So so this is what I have to say about the question that you asked me. And that question that you asked me, I think I got off track a little bit. So what was that question, Brother Tahaka?
Well, I was asking, were you of the persuasion that all of us are classified as African Americans? I mean, in other words, none of us was already here from the beginning of time. We all came from Africa. Is that your persuasion? That was the question.
No. I explained to you about the Spanish and Roman Catholic Church Inquisition.
Right.
To run those Africans out of Spain and out of the Vatican.
Okay.
And a lot of them went into Europe. A lot of them went back into Africa, settled in the countries such as Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and Mauritania. You see? And then a lot of them went into Mali. And from Mali, they went into Easter Island, where those big mega stone heads was built over there. And then a lot of them came into Africa. I'm sorry, into America. And they lived among the American indigenous Indians. So therefore, they came over here on their own in this hemisphere, and they lived among the American Indians, the indigenous Indians. Now, and they also came on the ship of Christopher Columbus, because Ferdinand and Isabella hired a ship owner by the name of Christopher Columbus to take the Moors out of Spain. So he loaded his ship up, and they found themselves over in America, the date the miracles that we know today in 1492. That's 127 years before the slave trade of 1619. You see? So now they set up a civilization over in this hemisphere, same like they did over in Spain and over in the Vatican, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's 127 years before the slave trade of 1619. So this, after that was set up, here comes 1619, bringing other Africans, men and women who will learn, men and women. They knew how to read and write. They were civilized and brought them over here to put them into a slave servitude in America. So now no one talks about the 127 years of civilization that the Moors, who are the ancient Egyptians, set up in this country. You see? So that once the slave trade set in, now they have to get rid of the Moors again. So how did they do it? They took the indigenous human beings that they brought over here, who were very highly educated men and women, put them into slavery over here, and put and mixed them in with the ancient. I'm sorry. With the Moors, and so they said now, once that was done, they put them all under one umbrella, and they called them all Negroes. Okay, so that's how they got rid of the Moors and any evidence of them coming over here. 127 years prior to slavery to bring civilization to this hemisphere. That's how they got rid of the Moors, by lumping the enslaved African out of Africa under one umbrella with the Moors, and saying that they were all Negroes. So that's how they invented a new people called Negro, a people that has no land identity and no language identity and no culture that could be tied back to Africa. See? So they created a new African right here in America, the American Negro. And the American Negro is the greatest Negro that has ever been walking this earth. In human form. He's a great man, great people, because look at the achievement that we have done while we're here. So anyway, that's my answer to you, Brother Shahaka.
Okay, well, Dr. Wing, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, because I have some more questions that I need to ask you, but I'm going to give you a little break, and y'all hold on, we'll be back, okay?
this is a response to a lot of people that message me on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, that have asked me multiple times, and I've just never had the chance to address it. They've seen me travel these countries, and they wanted to know how I was treated being black in Egypt. I'm actually Nigerian, Nigerian-American if you want to be technical. In my family, I am the first generation born in America, so that means my entire family and heritage and lineage is all back in Nigeria. My story starts back 6 months ago. I chose to go to Egypt to start my travel content creator business, life, however you want to call it. I quit my job to follow my dreams, and I wanted to go to Egypt first. And when I got to Egypt, it was kind of like a reprogramming of what I thought I knew about Egypt, because growing up in America, we are taught in the schools that being black is no more than having a enslaved ancestry. But once learning that, you kind of have this idea that you are nothing more, or African Americans in this country are nothing more than just enslaved prisoners to the old Americans that built, that forced the Africans to build this country. When you learn about Egypt, you see the pyramids, and that's all it is. You see that there's desert, that's all they tell us. So going to Egypt was kind of like a reprogramming of what I wanted to know about Egypt and see for myself. And in my mind, the Egyptians are like me. They are in Africa. They are in Northern Africa. Our cousins to where my mother comes from, which is Nigeria. It's not that far away. But when I got there, it wasn't as expected as I thought of the welcoming I wanted. Let me say that there's two types of people in the world, or at least in tourism. There's the hustlers, and then there's the general public. So I'm not going to generalize the Egyptians for the hustlers and the general people that I met, because they're not the same people. But I want to say these hustlers definitely treated me differently than my white counterparts that I saw in Egypt. I meet some Egyptians on my travels. We try to have conversations of like where we're from, what are we doing, how is Egypt compared to what I learned growing up, and it's not what I thought it was. And when I talk to certain Egyptians, it comes down to how they identify themselves, because to my knowledge, like, Egypt is in Africa. That's it. No matter how you want to look at it, Egypt is in Africa. If it's in the south, if it's in the north, if it's in the west, the east, it's in Africa. It's part of the African continent. And there are some Egyptians that I've met that just don't identify as Africans. Like, there was a video that went viral in Egypt where there was this Egyptian kid, like a teenager, and he enslaved a Sudanese child in Egypt. And I was just like, what? And you know, sometimes like I would talk to some Egyptians and they say they're not Arab, right? But they say they're not African either. Then what are you? I don't know. There's a weird disconnect when we talk about Africans and Egyptians as if they're not the same. And let me just say that I've been in Egypt for a while, not just a tourist that came for a week, went to the pyramids and dipped. Now, I actually went to Cairo and I stayed in Cairo. I was in Sheikh Zayed, New Cairo, Maidi, which is my favorite place. And I was in Alexandria, I was in Siwa, I was in Luxor, and I was in the south, I was in Aswan, I stayed in Nubian Village, I went to Abu Simbel, and then I went to the Sinai. I was in Sharm el-Sheikh, Dahab, Nueva, I was all over the place, even Fayoum, I was there. So I know what I'm talking about, and I'm not here to discredit anybody or anyone in Egypt. This is just, again, my experience, and I hope you guys can correlate to this, or you guys can connect with me on this. I want you to connect with me when I'm talking to you about this feeling that I got, this weird disconnect that I got in Egypt. How I'm feeling is like, growing up in America, I wasn't accepted as a black man, and then going to Egypt, we're not even brothers either. So it's like that love that I'm looking for in Egypt, I couldn't get it from those people. So it made me feel like I'm not even realm with them. You know, I thought we were like cousins or brothers, but you look at me as something else. These conversations hurt me a lot. And it's funny, I talk about the hustlers. Whenever I'm in like the hustling area of business, then you will hear the Egyptian hustlers say, brother, cousin, to kind of reel you in to buy things, you know, and that hurts. They don't realize it hurts someone like me, but it hurts, you know, to hear, like, you're only saying that because you want me to, because you want to profit from me, not that you want to engage with me. You don't want to bring me in as family, and then I meet some Egyptians that are like the ones that finish university or have a couple degrees or whatever. They're the ones that say, oh yeah, we're proud to be African. We are African 100%. And that's cool, but it's like, you know, I can't say a percentage of all Egyptians that I've met. It's just the ones that I've met. There's some that don't identify as African and there's some that do. So it's like, when do you have the choice to identify as what? Like, I've never met anyone in any part of the world that just had a choice of not identifying where their mother continent is. Even some Egyptians taught me, like, if you want to disrespect an Egyptian, call him African or call him a Sudanese. And I'm just like, I don't get that. Why? It's such a strange question when people ask you, what's it like being black in Egypt? And I'm just like, it's like, ask me, what's it like being African in Africa? Like, I don't really quite get that question. I can only tell you what I've experienced, because even there's certain parts of Cairo where there's a melting pot of Nigerians, and they're in Nasser City. They're not really in the upper class areas like Maidi or New Cairo or Sheikh Zayed or areas like that. And I was never even attacked or anything. This is nothing about physical damage. This is more emotional that I'm expressing to you. It's the emotional comfort that I wanted from my fellow Africans that I kind of didn't get from all of them. Just my close friends in Egypt I got. But it was a wake-up call. But I will say this. When I went to Aswan, I stayed in the Nubian village and I spoke with them. And they were telling me their history. They were saying they're not Egyptian. They are Nubian. They speak their own language. They make their own food. And they have their own land. And they have a history between the Egyptians and the Nubian people where they were even mistreated, to where they were, the Egyptians have all this land in Egypt, but they only gave the Nubian people this one part in the south. That's what they told me. And it's just, it's so confusing to me sometimes. It's like, I don't know what's what. Like, I thought they're all Egyptian. They're not. The Nubian people in Aswan are not Egyptian. That's what they told me. And don't be mad at me. I'm just a messenger. But with every negative, there's a positive. And there's definitely some good sides to the story. I've made one of the best close relationships I've ever had in my life in Egypt. I've made really good friends in Egypt, and I hold them to my heart dearly. And I'm thinking of a couple people right now. One is Reham, and one is Alia, and another one is Mina. These are like my three closest Egyptian friends that I have in the entire world, and they are everything to me. And without these people, I wouldn't even be standing where I'm at right now. Reham is definitely like number one in my life, you know. She taught me everything I needed to know about even content creation, how to voice myself, how to create content to sell people, and how to, you know, place my footprint in the world. And she's not even a content creator. She just understands how this works. You know, Alia is another friend of mine I met in Dahab, and, you know, me and her have a very close relationship as far as, like, what we want in the world. It's free bird, free spirit, and I love her energy and everything. And Mina is someone I met in the States, but he was the first Egyptian I ever met. And it's so funny, when I met him, I didn't even know what Egyptians look like, and I thought he was Italian at first. And when he told me he was Egyptian, he was like, in fact, brother, I'm more African than you. I'll never forget that moment, because that's what I want to hear, you know. Like, ever since then, we became best friends, you know. Like, he invited me to his wedding in Egypt, and I couldn't make it at the time. And then when I told him I'm going to Egypt to travel, I've been to places in Egypt he's never even been to, which is, like, something we can talk about now. I was like, I went to where he was born, and it's so crazy to talk about. I've had the best experience in my entire life in Egypt, the best. the best. Nothing can compare. And this is just aside from people, like, the landscape is crazy. The history is crazy. That's all I want to say and talk about. I hope we can have a great discussion in the comments below. Let me know what your experience was when you went to Egypt, or if you're...
Remember to pay yourself first. The greatest focal point in your life is when preparedness and opportunity meet. Mortgages, foreclosures, property taxes can be a thing of the past. It's all up to you to be in honor. We have public and we have private. When it comes to mortgages and foreclosures, the banks don't have no skin in the game. And property taxes are outright illegal. But if you don't know no better, you just keep drinking the Kool-Aid. Cut it out, y'all. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Now is the time to get out of debt. The opportunity is here. This is your greatest focal point. Let's shut this thing down, man. Get out of debt now. Peace.
Everybody, we're back. Our special guest is Dr. Walter Williams. I see we have another guest with his hand raised. I'm opening up the phone line. Let him in. Area code 312. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question, comment for our guest.
Okay. Good evening.
Brother Yoel.
This is Brother Yoel. We're in late here from the Windy City.
Okay. Welcome, welcome, my brother. Welcome, welcome. Let me open up Dr. Williams' line because I have another question for him. But before I get to Dr. Williams, I know he can hear me. I want to ask you a question, Brother Yoel. Now, this is the question I have for you. I'm going to ask Dr. Williams the same question.
Okay.
Prior to, as far as you know, prior to the so-called Native Indians being on this land, North America, were there any people classified as Negro, colored, or black already here before they got here? That's the question.
Before the Native American, so-called Native American.
That's right.
I would say yes. I know I can't
okay.
be black with that, but I say yes. There were.
Okay, well, what kind of evidence can you lay
well,
to the table for?
Well, when you talk about, I was talking to a guy there. Well, I wasn't talking to him, but then a guy was on the phone with, it was three-way call, and the guy was talking about how he just learned that there were, that the Mexicans had one time had eight south and western states in the United States. Well, I don't think he would realize that, in my opinion, and from what I've been able to discover, is that those eight states he's talking about were the Africans who were here already. You know, we're talking about the Omac people, and long before there was a Native American, well, I don't think there was anybody else here before us in this country. So then you got, I mean, sometimes if you understand Hollywood, sometimes it makes truths with falsehoods. They came before Columbus with Ivan Van Sertima. The other book by Lerone Bennett, Before the Mayflower. And there's other books that also have evidence of that. The Lost Treasures of King Juba by Frank Joseph. So any one of these books you pick up that's talking about the Olmecs will kind of validate that claim. So, but again, with the Hollywood thing, I remember Nicolas Cage's movie that he did on the National Treasures, and
right.
part of the truth that he let out in that movie was part two. I think it was in part two, came out mostly. He needed some transliteration of some language, and he took it to his mother, who was a linguist in the movie, and she translated the language. And then what he discovered in his search for his treasure that he was looking for, that this land belonged to the Olmec people. And he actually said that in the movie. Okay. So there's evidence that Africans were here before anybody in this region was ever here. And then when you go back to what you call Pangaea, or some refer to it as Gondwana land, and that was when all the land was locked. I mean, you weren't sitting there. You weren't sitting in the continent of Africa as we know it today, when all the rest of the land was landlocked. You weren't just sitting there in Africa on your hand waiting for the land to float apart and the European to come in and discover the rest of the world and stuff like that. We were already here. Now, ain't no telling how many thousands, if tens of thousands or longer. And actually, there's a book called the, I think it's the Penguins Atlas of the World, and it of Africa, that is. And in that book, it starts out with Africa or the land being landlocked, and then it says about 150 million years ago. Now, I don't know how they came with the figure that they did, but then they show where. Another page goes into when the land starts floating apart and stuff like this, right? And it talks about how many thousands of years ago that was. So there is evidence that there were Africans here already on this land called America. And if you look at that map and you look at how the land was locked, supposedly, according to that map that they drew, you can see why Moors call this Northwest Mexum. You know, it was in the north in that map that they, when the land was locked, and then you can see where it's also in the west. So Northwest Mexum would have some truth to it.
And maybe all the evidence is not in, and maybe it's still coming out. It's still coming out, but I put my money on the fact that I think that there were some, and they're going to continue to discover that there were even more, you know. So, yes, I would say so. And that also explains why Bolivia has twice as many black folks in it as the United States does, you know. So that's what I think, Tahaka. But I'm not the authority on it, but from based on my little bit of research and reading over the years, that's what I come to believe anyway that may have happened, you know.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Williams, I would like to ask you the same question, in your opinion, prior to there ever being any so-called Native Indians in here on this land. As far as you know, were we already here?
Well, you have to do investigative research by way of the discipline, using the discipline of history. I never heard any dates coming from what Yoel was talking about. Give me dates. Tell me about Ivan Van Sertima. I have no... let's say, I never took Ivan Van Sertima as being a real researcher in history. I never took any of those people. You tell me about what they're saying, but they're not giving you dates, times, people, and places. They're not doing that. Give me some dates, you know, and you tell me about where did they come? The question has to be asked, where did the people come from? That has been put on Indian reservations as I speak. They live there. Where did those people come from? See? No one, give me the answer to that. If they wasn't already here. Okay? Give me the answer to that. See, you can't have two indigenous land identity. You can't have Africa as a land identity, as to where you came from. You cannot have this Americas at the same time your identity. You can't have two lands to identify your racial and identity for. So I hear Yoel. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with Ivan Van Sertima. I don't agree with none of those people. See? So I explained to you in my narration on one of your questions about in the Spanish and Roman Catholic Church Inquisition of 1478 how this Ferdinand Isabella wanted to get rid of the Moors out of Spain and out of the Vatican, and that some of them went into Europe, some of them went back into the North African countries of Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, Mauritania, and then some went into Mali. The ones that went into Mali went into Easter Island, and they created those large stone heads over there that you see there now, and then into the Americas. See, so where the question has to be asked, where did the indigenous American Indian who are living on the reservation today, as I speak, where did they come from? What's the question? What's the answer to that? Ask you all that. I'm asking you, Brother Doc. I'm asking Brother Yoel.
Okay, well, I got Dr. Williams is too much information for me to bring out now, but what I am going to do is I'm going to give you the sources. I'll have to send that over there to you in an email give you the sources about the so-called black people on this landmass dating back hundreds and hundreds of years, including we have a pyramid, and this is just my personal opinion because I've seen the thing, but we have a pyramid right there in Oklahoma City, and this thing, it looks every bit of 300 or 400 foot high. And then, of course, we got the pyramid down here off the coast of Florida. Then we got the pyramids, the whole Egyptian city, including Egyptian statues and stuff, just like in Egypt, and pyramids right there off the coast of Bimini, right over there by the Bimini Wall. We've already seen that. But what I'm going to do. What I'm going to do is I'm going to send you the information so you can examine it for yourself. But I can't put it all on here. I got the records and stuff because we've been investigating this here now for the past 6 months, and we've turned over some of the most incredible information about our identity in America, the likes of which has never been heard. It's amazing. This stuff that's coming out now. And so I'm going to make sure that you have access to it.
All I'm asking you to do is give me your evidence now, at this very moment.
Well, I'm on the radio right now. I can't go, excuse me, and dig it up because I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm going
to
give it to you.
You're trying to prove.
Well, hold on a minute now. First of all, you already know I'm not an African. Didn't come from nowhere else. We've always been here. And this is what I'm going to provide you with the proof of, and so you can see it for yourself.
Do you call yourself a Moor?
I can hardly hear you.
Do you call yourself a Moor?
Am I a Moor? Yes, I am a Moor.
Okay.
And the reason why I'm a Moor and Egyptian, because I have access to the same sciences that both more than Egyptian have. I have the sciences. I have the supreme mathematics. I have the zodiac. I have the numerology. I have all of that.
Where did you come from as being a Moor? What's your land?
Well, I've always been. I didn't come from someplace else. That's my point.
Where's the land of the Moors?
Well, actually, the land of the Moors in Egypt is right here. That's what Tony Browder was trying to tell you.
Tony Browder, I have no respect for his scholarship.
Oh my God!
Because I paid $25.
All right. Well, Dr. Wynn, let's take a little quick break, and we'll get back on track, and we'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, y'all hold on a minute. We're going to a commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to go ahead and roll on out for the rest of the broadcast. Y'all hold on a minute. We'll be back. Oh, yeah. want to hear from my brother Ashanti. So if y'all hold on, we'll be back in a minute. Keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, the phone lines are wide open. The number to dial into the broadcast is 515-605-9757. Press 1 on your phone. That'll give me an indication that you have something to say. And I'll open up the phone lines so you can get in. Our special guest is Dr. Walter Williams. We'll be back with our guest here in a minute. And but in the meantime, we're still on break. We'll come back. If you got questions, go ahead and raise your hand and we'll let you in, okay? Y'all hold on a minute.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Harambe. Tonight we have a very special guest. He is one of America's most respected scholars of any ethnic persuasion, having authored more books than any contemporary African-American scholar. He is chair of Temple University's African-American Studies Department, having started the first doctoral program in African-American studies ever. He is Dr. Molefe Kete-Asante. Welcome to Harambe, Doctor.
I'm delighted to be here.
All
Thank
right,
you.
Brother, let's cut right to the chase. Were the ancient Egyptians black?
Yes. I mean, every indication that we have, historical information, linguistic, art, in terms of art, in terms of science, the ancient Egyptians were African people. And anyone, as John Henry Clark, the eminent historian, likes to say, who was in Africa, who was not black, was either an invader or the son or the daughter of an invader. Africans were black. And in antiquity, of course, the ancient Egyptians were black people.
Mm-hmm. Well, what categories of evidence do you have to support your contention that the ancient Egyptians were
black?
Well,
it's a curious question that you ask about the categories of support. And the reason it's a curious question is because no one asks, if you talked about the Greeks, no one will say to you, what proof do you have that the ancient Greeks were white people? Nobody asked that kind of question. They asked that question about Egypt, but the categories are numerous categories. But fundamentally, the ancient name of Egypt, of course, is not Egypt. Egypt is the Greek name, Egyptus, but the Africans called the land Kemet, which means the land of the black people. And so Kemet itself, in terms of just the language, in terms of the Medunetja, which is the ancient Egyptian language, in terms of that language, we know that they were black people. But not only that, but if you go and you look at the paintings on the tomb walls, what you see are black people. If you look at the indications, for example, in documents such as in the tomb of Ramses III, where you have the world's first ethnology, that's where you have a group of people representing different races. The Ethiopian and the Egyptian are both black people, and they look just alike. So that's evidence. I mean, then there's the evidence of the Europeans themselves. I mean, people, Greek people, like Aristotle and Herodotus. Aristotle says that the Egyptians that he saw, he says that they were black. In fact, he said they were very black. He said the Ethiopians and the Egyptians are very black. And this book is Physiognomonica. You can look it up. I mean, people can look that up. I mean, Herodotus says, for example, the people of Colchis must be Egyptians because, like them, they have black skin and woolly hair. So the ancient Egyptians were black according to the Greeks and the people who were, you know, observers who saw these people. So I don't think it's any question. I mean, the Egyptians never even, they never, I mean, this question would be crazy. It should not even be discussed. Anybody who thinks that the people of Africa, the Nile Valley region of Africa, and the Nile Valley civilizations were either European or were Asians do not know the document and don't know the facts of the Nile Valley history.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some detractors, Dr. Asante, would say, what difference does it make? I mean, with all the problems that people of African descent have today, what difference does it make that the ancient Egyptians were black? How do you respond to that?
Well, it makes a lot of difference. And the difference it makes is that, number one, you've got to have your facts straight. And in order to look at the contemporary situation, you got to have facts straight. And I think for school children, it's very important that people teach accurate information, not teach information that is distorted, that is false. I mean, I've gone to schools recently where young people believe that Egypt is not even in Africa. I mean, how does a kid in the eighth grade get to the point where she believes that Egypt is in Europe? The only way you can get to that point is because of the distortion of the information in people's minds and imagination. So when I say that it is important that we have this information, it's important for, number one, you teach accuracy. Number two, it's important because it relates directly to our perception of the African continent itself. I mean, to rob Africa of its classical civilizations is much like robbing Europe, for example, of Greece and Rome. I mean, so it is important in terms of perception, in terms of conception, in terms of how people view themselves, how we view each other, it is important that we have accurate information. The ancient Egyptians were black people, and the evidence, of course, by people like Sheikh Anta Diop, who did even melanin tests on the skins of the mummies of antiquity. I mean, all of these evidences are enough to demonstrate that if we talk about antiquity, you're talking about a black people. I mean, you're not talking about a European people or an Asian people. You're talking about people who, in fact, the further back you go in antiquity, the blacker the people are. So if you come forward, then you have, of course, the mixtures coming in, the Arab population coming in. But the Arab population doesn't come into Egypt in large numbers until 639 to 641 of this era, not in the BC era. In the BC era, there are no large influxes of people, with the exception of the invasions occasionally. One could point to the invasion, for example, in 625 of the Persians, and then the invasion in 333 of the Greeks. But these were not great influxes. The great influx was the Arab influx, which came from Arabia into Egypt, and that influx came in the 7th century A.D. and not in antiquity.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Egypt is designated as being in the Middle East as opposed to being a part of Africa, which we both know that it is. At what point in history, Dr. Asante, was Egypt taken out of Africa and placed in the Middle East, and why?
Well, the Middle East, and I've written about this too, as you point out. I mean, I've written about this a lot because part of what has happened is that people take the notion that Middle East, they believe that Middle East refers to a continent. It doesn't refer to a continent at all. I mean, we know that. It is a political entity and a political concept. And it's a political concept that came into being basically after the last great European war in the latter part of the 1940s, the early part of the 50s. So it's a political designation, but it's not a continental designation. There's no continent, Middle East. Egypt, of course, has always been in Africa. You can't take it out of Africa. You can drive overland from Ghana to Egypt. You can go from Kenya overland to Egypt. There's only one country separating them. You can go from Ethiopia to Egypt. You can go from Sudan to Egypt. They're on the same continent. But what happened was that in the top of the 18th century, in 19th century, after 1800, 1803, around that time, there was a deliberate attempt on the part of many European scholars to try to deal with what they had found in Egypt. I mean, the monumentality of the temples, the great extent of the tombs and so forth, which was more monumental than anything, and they had to try to take Egypt out of Africa.
Mm-hmm. We want to pick up a little bit more on that, but first we're going to take a break right here and give our viewers a chance to test their knowledge of history with our monthly feature, Black Facts. Thank you. we're talking with Dr. Malefe Asante of Temple University. Doctor, you want to pick up on what you were talking about, taking Egypt out of Africa?
Yeah, the point I was making, of course, was that in 1799, when the French invaded Egypt with the Grand Army of France, they discovered in the Nile Valley a civilization that was more majestic and more monumental than Greece and Rome combined. And it was a problem, I mean, because they had been teaching in European universities courses on the classics, and they meant by that, of course, the European classics, Greek and Latin, Greece and Rome. But when you find a civilization that was anterior to Greece and Rome and more majestic and monumental, in fact, there's more written material about this African civilization, the question is, what do you do with it? And I think that was the beginning of trying to take Egypt out of Africa. The idea was that it could not have been created by African people. I call it the legacy of disbelief. The idea that, wow, I mean, this is in Africa? How did these temples get in Africa? How did these columns get in Africa? How did the father of medicine get to be an African? I mean, how did the father of writing get to be an African? I mean, how did the originators of astronomy get to be African people? The originators of agriculture, of geometry, of surgery, of music, I mean, in terms of written music, of mathematics.
And this contrasted with the great enslavement at the same time.
This is exactly right. And, of course, while Africans were being enslaved during the same period of time in terms of the rediscovery, in a sense, by Europe of Africa, what had to happen was what Martin Bernal calls in his books Black Athena, you had to have an Aryan interpretation of history. The Aryan model of history was an interpretation that simply said this: it could not possibly be true that black people created a civilization like this. So that's when you get the idea that somehow Egypt is not a part of Africa.
Mm-hmm. What are the most noteworthy accomplishments of the Egyptian era?
Well, I think that there are numerous accomplishments, but I you have to remember it was a long. The ancient Egypt, of course, is the longest continuous civilization that we know of. I mean, if you go back to 3100 before the Christian era and you start there with the first dynasty, now, of course, you can go even earlier than that if you start with the 16 kings before Menes, who was the first king of the first dynasty. But if you look at that whole tradition, there were three golden periods in ancient Egypt before the first golden period in Greece. That sort of gives you the length of this history. I mean, you had a first golden period, which comes around the sixth dynasty, and then you had another one around the 12th, and then you had and the 18th, and then you had a stronger dynasty around the 25th and 26th. So you had, which were great in terms of the revival of architecture, the development of literary forms, and I think then that the fundamental contribution might very well be a spiritual contribution. I mean, even though you have all of these technical and material contributions, when you look at the ancient Egyptians' approach to life, and of course, the approach to life is the approach to death. I mean, the same thing. The idea of the eternal life and the concept of eternal life as symbolized in mummification itself and in the construction of the tombs, some of them 60 or 70 feet under the earth, of individuals who would construct their tombs there so that they could live in eternal life. I think the concept of eternal life was the biggest contribution that the Egyptians made if you look at the spiritual side of it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Egyptian mystery system.
Well, the mystery system was no mystery, of course, to the Egyptians. I mean, it was a mystery to the Greeks, but it was not a mystery to those people. I mean, they truly understood that if you looked at any of the great myths of Egyptian life, for example, the myths at Heliopolis or the myth at Memphis, where you had the construction of reality based on the deity Atum and Ptah. I mean, what you discover is that in order for a person to be well-educated, the Egyptians thought that it was necessary that a person go in as an initiate and learn various categories of knowledge. So the mystery system was, in fact, the first university system. I mean, this is why people have spoken of it as the Osiris-Ikka, the place, of course, where Osiris gave forth at least the knowledge of Osar, and the various attributions of Osar were very important for people in terms of learning how to pass through life.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the remaining tenets or principles that date back to the great Egyptian era that are still in place in what we know as Western civilization?
I mean, almost everything. I'm really being facetious, but when you've been to Egypt or when you study Egyptian history and culture, and when you look in the African Nile Valley, you come back to the West if you have never gone to Egypt, and you see everything. I mean, you look at the columns, for example, on banks and buildings, and you see the columns that people call Greek columns, and you know that these are Egyptian columns, and you know that they existed in Egypt 2,000 years before they existed in Greece, and that the Greeks got them from Africa. When you look at lions, when I drive down the street in residences and I look at lions out on people's lawns or entrance to their driveways, I recognize these as replicas of the Sphinx and concepts that came right out of the avenue of the Sphinx in Thebes, Luxor. So you have that. You have the pyramid, of course, which is everywhere. You have the Eye of Horus, which is on the back of the dollar bill. I mean, so almost everywhere you look, you see ancient Africa. I mean, it is almost impossible to escape, so much so that even if you take, for example, just the idea that ancient Africa gave to us the concept of measurement, the first people to measure with a nilometer, for example, the rising of the River Nile. I mean, this was, the concept of measurement itself was fundamental. I mean, you can look at not just measurement, but you can look at even at constructions of language, genres of literature. The autobiography was first given to us by the ancient Africans, the first autobiography in the world. You see, the autobiography of Winnie. The first philosophers were given to us by the ancient Africans. Harkuf, for example, Kagemni, Patahotep. These were philosophers who lived at least 2,000 years before the first Greek philosopher, who was Thales. So the problem is we don't know about this, and they don't teach this in school.
Okay, and that's exactly what we want to pick up on, Dr. Asante, is how is it that I can go through high school, college, and graduate school, and unless I went out and found books written by scholars like yourself, I would not know this information. We're going to talk about that. But we're going to take a break right here. We're going to chat some more with this very interesting man, Dr. Asante, right after this Black Facts. Stay with us. Dr. Asante, the structure of our education here in America, and I guess throughout Western civilization, is built on the foundations of the great Greek and Roman civilizations. What's wrong with that insofar as it relates to African Americans or people of African descent as well as people in general?
Well, the United States of America, of course, is a heterogeneous nation. It's a pluralistic nation. It is a multicultural nation. It has never been a monocultural society. And so what's wrong with the way education is constructed in this society is that it is constructed on a monocultural basis. In other words, What has happened is that whites have developed an educational system which really starts with them. But, of course, they're not the only people in the society. And we don't have an education system that is based on looking at a holistic picture of human culture. And so to start with Greece and Rome, which are very young civilizations, compared, for example, to the African civilizations of Kemet, Egypt, and Nubia, and the Asian civilization of China and India, both really, actually, to start with Greece and Rome is really not to start with antiquity. It is to assume a starting place and to begin a construction of knowledge based on that, as if that is all you need to know. And, of course, that is not all we need to know. I mean, if you only know that, you don't know very much. In fact, not only do you not know very much, you have a very distorted view of education, of knowledge, of culture, and you have almost no facts at all about the African past or African history or African people.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you say on a lecture circuit, because, you know, I followed you around quite a bit, and I've heard you say a number of times that African-American students sit in the classroom, yet they sit outside of the classroom experience. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean they don't have a sense of ownership of the knowledge that's being presented in the classroom. The child sits in a mathematics class and believes that mathematics came from somebody else. That child doesn't believe that mathematics is derived out of her own history or his own history. I mean, when in fact the earliest books of mathematics are African books, the Rhine Papyrus and the Moscow Papyrus. In fact, the earliest known mathematical abacus, calculator, was developed by the Esangi people of Zaire 28,000 years ago. So this is an African mathematical tool. But if you're sitting in a mathematics class and you're an African-American person and you feel that somehow math is something you have to go get because African-Americans or African people never experienced or developed mathematics, then your education is a poor education. You don't understand that all human beings have contributed to the various disciplines. So when the Latino child sits in the classroom, that child has to feel ownership of the information. When the African child sits in the classroom, that child has to feel ownership, just like the white child who sits in the classroom, whatever the field is. If it's literature, if it's social studies, if it's fine art.
Philosophy. Give me some examples of philosophy.
Well, in a philosophy class, I mean, what happens is that you have people will start with you with Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, as if there are no Indian philosophers, no Chinese philosophers, no African philosophers. And consequently, if you're educated in that system, it really educates you for white supremacy. It does not educate you to live in a heterogeneous, pluralistic, multicultural society. And so consequently, you have black people who become Clarence-sized. I mean, like Clarence Thomas. I mean, you're educated in a sense away from themselves, you see.
Now, what do you mean by Clarence-sized? I've heard you say that
before.
Well,
I just said it. I mean, these are African people who believe, in a sense, that they have no history separate from white people, that there is no tradition, historical or cultural, of African people outside of what they see white people having. So they see themselves as imitation of white people.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of what you feel classical music is.
I mean, it's simple. It's the African-American music, jazz.
It's not Bach. It's not Beethoven.
Well, that's a classical too, but that's a European classical.
Okay.
The classical is not a term that can be simply captured by one particular people and held. I mean, when someone and held as if it tightly, as if, wow, that's classical. I mean, part of what has happened in our education is that people have the imposition of the European worldview has been such that they have imposed themselves in a universal frame on everything. So if you say classical music, people normally think of European music. Well, that's one classical music. It's not, I mean, there's Japanese classical. I mean, there's classical music of the United States is jazz.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Asante, what's it going to take? I mean, you're obviously a very learned man and spent quite a bit of time gaining that knowledge. What's it going to take to get this kind of information in our high schools and colleges and universities?
We're moving on that now. I mean, there are a number of publishers, particularly Africa World Press and People's Publishing Group, who are doing an intensive development right now of books and articles just for this purpose. I mean, it's necessary for the whole society, not just for African Americans. I mean, this is an American problem, and it's an American issue. I mean, it's a vision of the society, how we live with each other, how we respect each other, how we understand each other. This is information that we all ought to have access to.
Time is very much of the essence. Why don't you tell me, what are the negative ramifications of...
There are none. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, okay. And insofar as whites or within our society of getting a one-sided depiction of history.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say what I was saying. No, but the negative side of that, I mean, is that if whites get a one-sided picture, then they do not know the whole truth. I mean, you have to have all the parts, and we all have to have all the parts. Certainly African Americans have access to white information. White people rarely have access to information about Africa and African people. In fact, even the most learned do not sometimes have information. And so their learnedness is not learnedness in terms of a holism. It is only a particular knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And let me just say this. As always, we welcome your comments, your constructive criticism, and program ideas. And you can write to us at the address on your screen. The address will be repeated.
Okay, everybody, we're back. Let me open up area code 314. 314, you on the air.
What did you say, Taharka?
Hey, what's going on, my brother? Hold on 1 minute.
Where is Walter?
Walter's here with us. I'm going to open up his line in a minute, but we got another line. Caller with his 312. Let me open up that line as well. Erico, 312, you're on the air.
It's me, Taharka Yoel, from Underground Bookstore.
Okay, well, let me open up Dr. Walter Williams' line here. Dr. Williams, are you still awake?
Yes. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're here. Brother Pianchi is with us, and Brother Yoel with us.
Brother Pianchi and Brother Yoel, welcome.
How you doing, sir? The Kansas City, Missouri School District with the Kansas City chapter of NBA, National Black United Front, Ujamaa Webster, Audre Ballard, and others, they formed African-centered curriculums in the public school district. And it had begun with Audre. Audre went to Africa, West Africa, and studied for a year and came back. And that's what they wanted to put in the school. And they had an ad hoc committee, which was the parents. And I think they changed superintendents. Williams was one, then another one came in, and he didn't like the program. So he wanted to put something different in, and he got Malefe Asante. And another lady, I can't think of her name, she has a charter school in Philadelphia. They came into Kansas City and basically tore down, to a certain extent, what they had built up with the other group. Now the stuff don't even exist, hardly of any, in Kansas City. So nobody tells that story. Malefe does some good work. He mentioned People Publishing. He done a African-American history book, which when he tried to put Malcolm X's picture on the cover, People's Publishing said, we can't do that. So they left it off. He has often had King and Marcus Garvey and probably some others. But that's true. That's how that program began to meet its demise. They had two elementary schools, King and Ladd. They had a middle school, and they had Southwest High School. And, they had Chick. and King and Ladd in middle school, and then it had Southwest High School. Southwest High School was really modern. It had everything in there you could think of. It had a petting zoo. The auditorium was fixed so that someone who was giving a presentation, it was just like the UN. The kids would have on their headphones, and no matter what language they spoke, the kids heard it in English.
What's the connection?
I was just telling you what he done. And
well,
I can't think of the lady name.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you something, Brother UL. What's your opinion, you and Brother Pianke, what's your all opinion on the working scholarship of Brother Tony Browder? What's your opinion?
Well, for me, Professor William and I have talked about what Tony Browder is doing right now, and you basically said, we basically kind of concluded the truth of the matter right now is he happened to dig up or he happened to grave rob right now. So, you know, I don't know what his thoughts is about that, but, you know, when that's like if you can't beat him, join him, and he's joining him. So, you know, but his other work that he's done is good work. They're from the Browder Files and now Browder Contributions to Civilization, you know, but the moves that he's making right now, I don't think I necessarily agree with what he's doing. I think maybe he's going off into something with a different kind of mindset, if you might say. You know, that's what
well,
I think.
Well, what
about
is he doing right now?
He's digging. He's helping some Caucasian over in Egypt digging up parts of Egypt over there.
Okay. What's your take, Pianke?
No, Tony's brother does very good work. Anybody can go over and become an excavation team. One of the requirements is that you have to be able to speak and read Latin, though.
But you can't call it an excavation on one hand when we doing it, and then you call it grave robbing when it's them digging up our ancestors, though.
Well, it ain't nothing to rob now. Heck, I was on a site there at Hadiwafa around the first cataract, digging through garbage that dated back over 65,000 years ago. So it's not grave robbing. What was ever in those tombs, and that's been gone a long time ago. And I'm on the pretension, too, that just because people's skin is not white, that don't mean they're your kin. You're talking about going back 20, 25 generations. And even in that country, the Kushites and the Egyptians didn't get along because they were mixed. Hey, even Namur tried to join them two together as an alliance in order to fight off invaders.
That's a whole other conversation right there.
Well, it is, but if you go over there, you can see the stories. It's all written all over the place.
Well, Brother Pianke, you want to give us a rundown on this Cleopatra thing, man, that we discussed the other day?
Cleopatra the Seventh was a Persian. She was not what people want to call as black. She was Persian, which is present-day Iran. It was seven Cleopatras. And I believe that Cleopatra is a title just like Caesar is. But Cleopatra the Seventh was Persian. And look at the time frame when she was in Egypt. The first people to come in there is caused a bunch of crap after the Hittites and the Hittites were the Assyrians. The Assyrians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, 30 BC, and Arabs.
You say the Hyksos?
Yeah, that was the Benoins. They called themselves Hyksos, sea people that sailed in down in the lower, at the mouth of the Nile around Avaris by ship, boats, and they caused some problems.
And Dr. Williams, are you in agreement with the Hyksos
No, I have a in my new book. It's coming out this latter part of the summer, early fall. I have a chapter in there, The Repudiation of the Hyksos. And that'll explain to you my repudiation of not agreeing with a Hyksos because it's biblical. The Hyksos are in the Bible. So you can't use that for human history. So that's my answer to you.
Okay, well, Bianchi?
Well, there's historical context on Hyksos. That's why Colonel Norman was trying to combine the Cushites and the Egyptians. Egyptians were mixed. They were mixed people. Not with Europeans. They were mixed with Asians. Cushites and Asians mixed together. That's why Colonel was fighting. The Cushites forbid it mixing. They were an ethnocentric society. But as time went by, just like anything else, things began to change. Matter of fact, their God, Amen, forbid it, mixing.
So
that's what the question with Black Americans saying that they ancient this, that, and the other. Well, even amongst their spiritual system, they would have fought you too the same way the Ashanti would over there in West Africa today. That's just society. That's what societies do. The Jarawa there on the Adam and Allah, they the same way. Today, right off of India.
Well, what were the original Egyptians? Were they African? Hello? Is anyone out there?
I had myself on mute. Yeah, you had people there on the landmass of the continent that was mixing, and some didn't. That's just the way it was. Arabic.
So
Arabic is the African language, by the way. It's the only African language that is not on the continent.
Let me comment on this.
Okay.
All right. You speak about the Cushites. Cush is one of the sons of Ham in the Bible. Okay? That's biblical. You can't use that. Cush is the father of Nimrod, of Babylon. Nimrod and Babylon is in the Bible. You can't use that for human history. Okay? So you got to go back to the Bible and you find Noah and his ark and Noah's three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. You will find that Canaan is one of the sons of Ham in the Bible, the Canaanites. Elam, the Elamites, is one of the sons of Shem. You see, Akkad, Akkadian, is one of the sons of Shem. All this is in the Bible. It has nothing to do with human history. So don't confuse the two together. You see? So they all make up what is known as the family and table of nations in the Bible only. They're not human beings. They're created creatures, created characters. They're characters of the Bible. So you have to know human history before you can understand what you're talking about. If you don't know human history, then you won't know what you're talking about. And going back to my question to you, Brother Tahaka, the Indians that are on the reservations today as I speak, where did they come from? Where did they originate from to get over here in this hemisphere of America?
Okay, the information that I have is they was brought here by the Phoenicians from the mountains of Palestine.
First place, there's never been no Phoenicians. That's biblical, the Phoenicians. biblical. You find the Phoenicians only in the Bible, with the color purple.
Okay.
You find them. Okay. Biblical.
So
now, where I ask you a question again. The Indians that were on the reservation today, as I speak, where did they come from to get over here in America?
They came from the mountains of Palestine. That's the information
Palestine
that I have.
Bible. That's biblical. Palestine is only found in the Bible. There's no such thing as a Palestine.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, and I think I've already gave Brother Yule this information, but I'm going to put it together and put it in an email. I won't be able to do it tomorrow because I got a ton of work to do, but I'll send it over there, and it's in video format. You don't have to worry about reading anything, and all you got to do is just check that out. But
did you put this information together that you're going to send to Brother Yule or
yeah.
me?
This is part of, if you let me, let me say something, Dr. Williams. I'll be more than happy to speak.
I'm giving you time now to speak. Did you put this information?
If you let me say something, I'd be more than happy.
Don't send me nothing in no document.
Y'all hold on a little minute. We'll go ahead and take a break, and we'll be right back.
Hello, everybody. It's me again, Tahaka. America is experiencing some tough times today. But there's a way out for you. All you have to do is get into the private, live out your days as a secured party and a creditor, instead of living as a debtor. I'll show you how. Visit TahakaDebtElimination.org. My contact information is there. It has to be tough struggling trying to make ends meet. But as a secured party and creditor, life's a little bit sweeter. All your bill collectors got you listed as a debtor. Let's turn this thing around to TahakaDebtElimination.org. Peace.
It's bad, you know.
She asked me why. I just went on and told her. She asked me why. I just went on and told her.
Okay, everybody, we're back. Now, let me open up these phone lines here. And Brother Yoel, you still with us?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us how to get a hold of them books, man?
Yes, I can, absolutely. Before I do that, let me just say that I'm Professor Williams, the historian here, not me. So I just read stuff, and I don't really... I got a wide range of stuff that I read, so I don't become an expert on too much of any of it. But I will say that I'm just finding out with validation that to kind of lend some credibility with what we're talking about here is that I found out a guy who's a historian and been bringing out something recently, and it's the second time I've heard it, but he showed me evidence or in writings of some things that were being revealed about, for instance, Daniel Webster, that Daniel Webster wasn't a white man as they told us that he was, and also John Marshall. He showed evidence, but it also speaks to something that I was told about 30 years ago, that they themselves would be the destroyer of themselves with their own records, and that looks like what's happening right now. So they can get a hold of them books at Underground Bookstore in Chicago, telephone number 773-768-8869, 773-768-8869, or they can email me at undergroundbookstore1@gmail.com. I'll be happy to try to find whatever book they might be looking for. And I don't just get black books, I get white books too, okay? So some people think that I just deal with black books written by black people.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for that. I want to I'll probably call you. If I don't call you tomorrow, I'll call you the day after tomorrow and stuff, because I wanted to discuss some things with you about our ancient presence in the Americas. And I know I've already sent you a ton of information over there. Look, I don't have a whole lot of time, but I acquired information. We do an investigation on the video information that is stayed in, and we check out the books and stuff, because you can pull the books up right there online and examine them for yourself. I'm not writing down stuff, stacking it over here. I wrote down a complete list of books. Boy, I don't know where that stuff is. It's in my folder and stuff. Where I can bring this information out. But what I want to do is get with you.
Okay.
And we can get online, get on the air, and we can bring this information out. And that way the people will be able to go straight there and see it for themselves and look at it for yourself. I know you heard about the Africa having over 640
plant species that they're using for food. And we also found out of the 640, 600 of those plant species came from the Americas. So I want to bring that information out so that they can go ahead and check it out for themselves and verify themselves. Also, the information in the Library of Congress, we have access to all of that as well. Pianca, you want to give us some last words before we close down? Because I'm getting ready to shut it on down.
Well, I was going to say this. If you go to Wasatch, which is Aswan, you cross the Nile and go over to the West Bank, where it's called Deseret, where Mentuhotep's tomb is.
Mm-hmm.
And at his tomb, Mentuhotep, but he led successful campaigns against the Libyans, the Asiatics, and also the Nubians. But in the Cairo Museum, which was found at his tomb, it was models of Kushite warriors. This is Kush with a K. The biblical Kush was created at the Council of Jamnia around 78 A.D. Mentuhotep is like the 11th dynastic period, which is about 2000-something before the Common Era. And, they're there. Mentuhotep was a unifier also, just like Narmer, because he led armies to go over to Libya. Libyan people aren't black, and they're on the African continent, by the way. But he led warriors. That's what he done back in those days. And that's a whole different people than what's down in West Africa. A whole different people. People need to come to terms with that, but those people do, but other people don't.
Well, let me ask you guys this. Do you think it was a global flood actually happened? Based on the evidence now.
That flood story. Go ahead, Walter.
I'm going to open up Walter's line when we get ready.
Where you get the flood story comes from the goddess Nut coming on her menstrual period and flooding the land. But in actuality, what you call now the Mediterranean Sea was nothing more than a valley. Because where it joins now presently at the Straits of Hercules, that there was landlocked. And it broke through. And the Atlantic waters rushed in and flooded that valley. Now, you had some small bodies of water because the Tigris and Euphrates emptied there to form small lakes, but nothing like what it is today at sea level. It's just the same way it was before they put in the Panama Canal, but the Suez Canal. That spot there was landlocked. That's why on this story about Moses, if Moses had to walk about a mile to the north, he could have walked around that strait on dry land. He didn't have to go through this biblical story and call it spreading the water. And that wouldn't have worked neither, because the bottom of the sea at that point is about 3,000 feet, and it's narrow. So you couldn't establish a slope for horses to go up or come down on either side. So that there is nothing but a myth. All civilizations have myths. Now, the thing is about Asar, Aset, and Heru, those were real people. Asar was a real person that was legendized, then to become deified as time went on. It's part of what they call the Shem, Su, Heru.
What about Yahshua? Who is that?
Well, Ashur and Asar, basically. Oh, you mean Ashur? What Ashur?
Yahshua.
Ashur was the god of the Assyrians.
Mm-hmm.
With Sennacherib.
All right. Well, we're down to 9 minutes. Let me bring Dr. Walter Weed, man, because we're going to close on down, man, because I got a ton of work to do tomorrow. Dr. Williams, could you tell us how to get a hold to your books?
Well, see, you cut me off from asking questions. You did that on
purpose.
Yeah,
I had already answered you, but could you tell us how to get a hold to your books? We're down to the last few minutes.
I want to ask you all some questions. Okay.
We're down to the last few minutes. Go ahead.
No, you got to give more than a few minutes for him to answer this question.
That's all we got is a few minutes. Go ahead and ask your question.
This is not on purpose, okay? I don't appreciate this, okay? Don't do this.
I'm going to go ahead and mute your mic. We're down to the last few minutes, so we're going to go ahead and close off the air.
Hear me.
All right. Fellas, we're down to the last little few minutes and stuff. Y'all got anything else to say? Because I'm going to go ahead and close it on down. So we don't have anything else to say. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate y'all being on. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and until next time, y'all have a good evening.
Benefits of becoming a secured party. Number one, operating financially in the private. Number two, controlling all assets of the corporate fiction. Number three, avoiding the legal system, which includes police and courts. Four, having access to your direct treasury account. Many wealthy and well-to-do people use this benefit every day. You will benefit in this way because of the current financial structure of the U.S. and other countries. You can operate right in the privacy of your own home. And you gain the benefit and avoid the losses by starting now, today. Contact me, Tahaka, and I will show you how to do it. Go to www.tahakadebtelimination.org. Child support, student loan, mortgages, foreclosures, property taxes, you name it, credit card debt. It's just a drop in the bucket once you get yourself in the proper status of commerce. Contact me, Tahaka. Peace.